Hello and welcome to Bread and Rosaries, a podcast about the UK, Christianity and the left. Before we get started on this week's episode, Adam and I just wanted to send our love and solidarity to the Reverend Jarrell Robinson Brown. For those of you who don't know, he recently tweeted saying, "The cult of Captain Tom is a cult of white British nationalism. I will offer prayers for the repose of his kind and generous soul, but I will not be joining the National Clap," i.e. the event organised by Boris Johnson to commemorate the life of Captain Tom through a clap. Obviously, I would imagine most people listening to this podcast agree with Adam and I that this was an entirely correct tweet, and if anything, the only critique of it is that it was too gentle. Unfortunately, most of the people in the world do not agree with that. It has led to Reverend Robinson Brown receiving a large amount of homophobic and racist abuse, and it was, frankly, made worse by the statement by the Diocese of London, which said the tweet was unacceptable, insensitive and ill-judged, even after Reverend Robinson Brown had removed it himself and apologised. Pretty clearly, it's horrible what's going on at the minute. We condemn everyone who's sending him abuse, but we also encourage people to stand up for the Reverend Robinson Brown's right to express a thought-through critique of white nationalism and how it functions in our society from a Christian perspective. Indeed, it is exactly what our clergy should be doing. There is a change.org petition essentially declaring support for Reverend Robinson Brown and asking the Diocese of London basically to do better. We will post that in the show notes, and if anyone feels the same way as us, we encourage you to sign it. But as I said, full support and solidarity to Jarrell Robinson Brown in this time. His original tweet was correct, and he deserves the support of his diocese, and most certainly does not deserve the attacks of homophobic and racist abuse that he is receiving. This week's episode is the second half of our interview with the Professor Anthony Reddy. The first half came out last week and was very interesting. I would encourage you to go and listen to that already if you haven't. You'll hear my voice, Ben Molyneux Hetherington, whose pronouns are he, him. You'll hear the voice, as always, of Adam Spears, whose pronouns are also he, him. And also with he, him pronouns, Professor Reddy himself will be speaking. For those of you who don't know, Anthony Reddy is one of the original pioneers of black liberation theology in a UK context. He has written a number of books, including Is God Colourblind, which recently was re-released with a fascinating afterword on Black Lives Matter, which we discuss later in the podcast. Wanted to talk about jazz a little bit,
yeah,
because you talk about jazz as a theological technique in particularly biblical interpretation. I think that was really, really fascinating and a really interesting kind of way of approaching it. But I was also reflecting a bit on jazz in the UK, and I don't know kind of how aware either of you are of the kind of jazz movement that's been happening the last probably 5 or 6 years. In the UK, coming out of the Steam Down nights in London. But there's been essentially this attempt to create a British form of jazz that is recognising that jazz exists, drawing on kind of black historical forms like blues, and then obviously became taken over by white people, as is famous in jazz. But actually, that's an American black musical tradition, and in the UK there are black musical traditions like reggae, like dub, like grime that can be drawn on to create a black British jazz, and there's been really you know, some really cool stuff. I wouldn't, you know, say that I'm any sort of expert on it, but there has been some great music coming out. We talked about Nanny of the Maroons. The band Sons of Kemet put an album out called Your Queen is a Reptile, and each of the tracks on it is My Queen is, and then a black woman of note, and one of the tracks is My Queen is Nanny of the Maroons, and there's My Queen is Doreen Lawrence as well, and a number of other fantastic titles for an album. And I just thought it was quite interesting to reflect on in terms of that relationship between black theology in the States and black theology in the UK, because it feels like there's been a similar sort of process. You know, the Black British jazz is very respectful and very, you know, there's a lot of cross-pollination with American jazz, but it is attempting to find something specifically British and specifically black and British, obviously, in jazz. And it feels like that's comparable in some ways to what you and other people have been trying to do in black theology in a British context.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I'll try not to make the parallels too easy, because obviously, you know, I'm not, there are differences between jazz and black theology. But yeah, I mean, so for example, when I see what younger people in Britain now are developing in terms of black theology, there's a sense in which they are doing much more eclectic work and drawing upon a broader range of sources than I would have done, let's say, someone who was, let's say, a first generation person trying to do that. So in some regards, I'm not sure if this is that helpful a comparison, but I'll do it anyway, just because, you know, I mean, I quite like the comparison, is that I've always seen myself as being someone who was a bit like Courtney Pine. So Courtney Pine is really one of the, I guess, patriarchs of black British jazz music. But what was interesting, like, if you look at his early development, he was very much a kind of, maybe pastiche is too strong a term, but he was certainly very influenced by John Coltrane. And I think as his career has developed, he has developed more confidence to move away from a Coltrane aesthetic to say, well, actually, I'm Caribbean. I'm born and brought up in West London. And so he has used hip-hop and rap and grime, and particularly reggae and dubstep, as ways of saying, well, essentially, jazz is about improvisation. So long as you can do improvisation, like you can improvise on any particular musical genre. And so I think he's tried to think, well, what specific is it about me being a black person of Caribbean descent, born and brought up in London, that is not the same as John Coltrane, who was born in North Carolina and did his work in New York, and, you know, in the late 50s and 60s. That, I think, is a parallel. I would probably say that my early work was very much derivative of America. So it was very much about saying, well, this is what Cohen and people in America have done. What would be the British equivalent? And trying to find my particular approach. But I think the older I've got, the more confident I've become to say, that's not to say America is still not an inspiration, but essentially, what is different? And so some of the stuff I've done around Caribbean proverbs, some of the stuff I've done around oral traditions, using the Windrush generation has been, I think, my ongoing attempt to try to find a more contextualized way. And similarly, I think Robert Beckford is doing something similar. So Robert's most recent work was a musical album he made with a number of grime artists where they took biblical texts, they turned them into musical tracks with videos, and he has written some of the lyrics to that with different performers to create a black British form of black liberation theology that plays out through that particular musical genre. I think for younger generations who hopefully will have us as their antecedents and not necessarily just James Cohen, hopefully they will be freer to go even further because they will have a platform that says, well, actually, we don't have to go straight to America now to start this conversation. Actually, what we can do is that, like, we can read Roberts' Jesus is Ready that came out in 98, that's over 20 years old now. Or we can look at Anthony Reddy's Faith Stories and the Experience of Black Elders that was published in 2001. So that's 20 years this year. As ways of then saying, well, where then do we go next? I'm also aware of the fact that I'm now in my, well, I'm 56, so I'll be 57 October. So technically, I'm nearer 60 than 50. And so I realise that I'm a person of my time. So when I talk about Black British jazz, I'm still thinking of Courtney Pine, because that's the person I first encountered. Some of the names that you're mentioning, I haven't got a clue. I mean, I'm too old and too past it for that kind of stuff. So I just acknowledge that part of the trick of growing older is to have the generosity to say each generation has to find their own way of speaking, theologizing. And whilst it's good that they might draw upon some of my work, it's not for me to impose my work upon them, because they're fighting. It's the same war, as we said before, but different battles. I mean, I think one of the things I've always been clear about, and fun fact, actually, it was like just the other day, I was talking to a young woman who's looking to develop her work in women's theology, and she's 29, so she's much younger than I am. And she was talking about, well, I'm thinking about doing this, but I was wondering if it would be okay with you. And I was like, no, you don't need my permission. But actually, one of the things that I think Black theology has always argued for, and I would uphold this as well, is that there's no magisterium, that there's no kind of council that exists as authority to police this stuff and tell other people what they should do. That has always been one of the singular problems with theology. And so I think one of the breaks that liberation theology made, which is why it's still radical and is viewed with suspicion by authorities, because once you start with this hermeneutic of suspicion that says, actually, like, we don't trust any authority, all authorities to be questioned and critiqued, whether religious or not, then what you have is arguably traditions and elders who, if they do their work well, will have levels of respect, because that's what sensible people do. Sensible people will learn from their elders, but the elders don't impose. So when I met James Cone was incredibly gracious. I mean, particularly when I gave a paper one day in America, which was what became part of Black theology and transatlantic dialogue. So I was playing around with Jamaican patois. And again, that was another way of trying to contextualize it, because that's the language I grew up with at home in terms of my parents speaking Jamaican patois. So I thought, well, let me theologize around this, because it's something I've witnessed all my life. It's been disregarded, it's been denigrated, it's been disparaged, it's been told it's terrible English and only poor working class people speak like this, proper middle class people learn to speak proper good English kind of thing. And therefore, take the logic of God's revelation. Well, if it's despised, then surely God is in it. God is there. Anyway, so I give this paper. And of course, African Americans haven't got a clue what I'm talking about, because they look at me thinking, what on earth are you? Because obviously, Jamaican patois doesn't mean anything to them. Cone could have come up to me and said, what a load of bollocks are you talking about? I'm sorry, but I don't understand a word. You call that theology? No. He comes with a big grin and says, Smith says, I didn't get much of that, but what I got was a fire and the passion that tells me that this is important. I don't understand it, he says, but I don't need to, because you're not writing for me. That you're writing for your context. And so long as you believe that what you're doing is speaking truth to power in your way, and you're critiquing vested interests that have existed in the mainstream, then what you're doing is fine. And so I've always tried to repay that generosity he gave to me, to say to younger people, you don't need my permission, because I have no authority over you. All I'm trying to do is to create a tradition that is generous enough and expansive enough to give space to everyone. But however, so all that said, I think the only critique I would make is when people who are not committed to it are trying to colonize the idea without the commitment. So I will be you know, I mean, like, so one of the few times I did get a bit stranded, so let me not sort of come across as this as a nice, fluffy, idealized liberal here. That's certainly not me. Was I do remember being at a particular conference where a younger African guy came up and said, "Oh, I want to develop a prosperity gospel of liberation." And I can't tell you the exact words I used, because obviously, like, this is broadcast, but let's just say that it's not the kind of language of which, like, my parents would ever have approved. But, like, there was the, yeah, but what the, no, sorry, but that's just nonsense.
Yeah.
But however, my critique of it was, that cannot be black theology. That is an oxymoron. That's not black theology. That's what I'm critiquing it for. If he was doing something that was genuinely liberative, challenging and radical, but not necessarily my thing. So I remember sitting in a seminar about 5 years ago where there were sort of two younger black people in London, I think part of Birkbeck College, and they were talking about grime and drill music. And to be honest with you, you know, I mean, at that point, I felt every inch like my, like, 52 years. It's like, okay. I could feel myself thinking like my dad used to say to me, actually, like, when he was my age and I was much younger, thinking, bloody hell, call this music, it's just bloody noise. Now, in my head, I said that. Outward, I thought, you know, something, this is clearly not for me. This is not my thing. These are people in their 20s doing their thing. Therefore, like, my only critical question is this liberative? Is this challenging the status quo? Is this providing space for people to be themselves and to be emancipated? That's the only question I'm asking. If it's doing that, then that's within the tradition I've helped to develop.
I think that's a really important thing, a takeaway that I really wish that more of us would take on board. Particularly when I was a teenager, I was guilty of this thing that I think a lot of people do, and that certain family members, who I will not name directly, still do, where they'll say, "Oh, well, you can't spell crap without rap." And, you know, like, I have a very white taste in music.
You can say that again.
I like, you know, it's diverse, but it's still white, right? Yeah. I like some stuff from here and there, but, like, what I've stopped saying a long time ago was, you can't spell crap without rap, because what I realised was that, you know, apart from anything, there are many different kinds of rap, and many of those, if not all, have come out of communities that are responding and reacting to being under the oppressive thumb of authorities. And so for me, you know, it was a big lesson to learn that you can't just dismiss something like that comes out of a community that you are completely ignorant of.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you know, I think an interesting generational shift. So this is within, I guess, the kind of mainstream of the black theology fraternity, which often meets within the American Academy of Religion. So every year, usually third week in November, most of the major scholars all descend on a major city in America for the American Academy of Religion. And basically, it's about 10,000 people, made all professional academics in different genres. And within that, there was, like, the black theology group. So I think today, I think I'm the only non-African-American to co-chair it. So there's always a male and a female who kind of co-lead it for a period of 3 years at a time. And every year, like, they organise different panels. And certainly I remember one year, there were a number of younger scholars in their 20s, mainly women, actually, who were looking at hip-hop and rap as their way of doing black and womanist theology. Like, they weren't looking at the Bible, they weren't looking at traditional hermeneutics, all the stuff that all of us that have been trained to do, and they were just doing it differently. And actually, what was interesting was that the people a generation above me, so the likes of the Cones of this world, were much more relaxed about this than the people who were, let's say, younger in, like, the immediate generation. So I can think of at least a couple of men who were really quite dismissive of it, because, like, and actually a lot of it's to do with power. Because I think one of the things that, and again, I wrestle with in my own work, and I try to subvert it as best I can, acknowledging that I'm still playing a game. So let me not, you know, so try to come across as too virtuous. So, yeah, I mean, so I've got this fancy title of professor. So I'm an extraordinary professor of theological ethics at University of South Africa. I work in Oxford. Part of what then comes with that title is a certain level of mastery. So you read the books, you do the stuff, you teach other people, and you now assume that even all of us say, notionally, oh, yeah, but all of us have got stuff to learn. All of us are still learners. Yeah, well, that's what we say, but like, we don't really mean it necessarily as academics, because like, we assume that when we get to a certain point, we know. And therefore, it takes at best humility, but at worst, a real insecurity when you come across something that, quite frankly, you just don't know. So, you know, like, so people are doing something and you can't get a handle on it. And it's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. So here's two things. Either, well, three things. The best posture is humility and say, you know, this is something else I need to learn about. Acknowledging that in learning it, I may never become a master of it in the way in which I've mastered other stuff, because clearly it wasn't created by me for me. So at best, I may well say, you know, I may be able to hold down a reasonably intelligent conversation over a drink in a bath for about 5 minutes. But that's about it, really, to be honest with you, because it's not my thing. That's the best posture, humility. The middle one is to try and really wrestle with it in order to learn it, which I think is good, but sometimes that learning it is then, that one is doing that then to try and undermine the people who are developing it, or still to retain your mastery. The worst posture of the three is to dismiss it. And oftentimes when people dismiss something, it tells you more about them than it does about the thing they're dismissing. Because essentially what they can't live with is the insecurity of not knowing. And I think there's something about the ascent up the ladder intellectually within the academy that doesn't lend itself to a certain type of humility that says, you know something, I don't have to know everything. I know what I know. But like, there's lots of stuff I don't know. And I think the best academics can live with that. The ones that are not so good are the ones that feel that it all always has to be about them and they have to have mastery. And if they don't know it, then it's not worth knowing. That's just bad scholarship, you know?
So I wanted to move us a little bit into kind of thinking more practically, I guess, about theology rather than about politics,
yeah,
rather than theology in the abstract. And I guess I want to start with kind of a question of, you've talked how Black Christianity, even its more conservative and you know, Pentecostal forms, does politically tend to the liberal and the left. You know, Black people, by and large, this country vote for Labour, right? That's why you can get away with talking about draping yourself in the flag all the time, because you just take black votes for granted.
Yeah.
But I'm interested to know, kind of, how does black theology in the UK, or black liberation theology, I should say, conceive of politics? What is kind of the approach there?
Jesus weeps for Gaza. He sees the pain and suffering of the 1.9 million people who have been forced to leave their homes without access to nutritious food, clean water, decent shelter. He hears the cries of the 25,000 orphaned children. He is with all who mourn the 250 people killed every single day. Christians for Palestine UK is a group of Christians who are calling for an immediate ceasefire in Palestine. We don't pretend to have all the answers, but are united in our prayers, hope and action for equality, peace and justice for all the peoples of the Holy Land. Together, we are organising a Christian presence at the National Marches for Palestine and local Days of Action, where we've been joined by siblings from Sabil Kairos, Pax Christi, and a whole range of Christian churches. We urge you to join us to act in solidarity with the people of Palestine and call for a permanent ceasefire and just peace. The Very Reverend Canon Richard Sewell, Dean of St George's College in Jerusalem, says, I warmly welcome the newly formed group, Christians for Palestine UK. Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank need to see the solidarity of Christians in the UK, and they will be encouraged to see your commitment to stand up for them in their time of terrible suffering. To find details of local actions or to join the Christian bloc at a national march, follow Christians for Palestine UK on Instagram and Facebook, or email christiansforpalestineuk@gmail.com. Join us as we call for a ceasefire now.
Yeah. I mean, it's always been on the left. And I think, as I said, I think that's always been taken for granted. I think it's become just so assumed that sometimes I'm not sure it's been given enough investigation and analysis, because it's just been so assumed that essentially I think that because the roots of Black theology in Britain come out of migrant experiences and come out of people who are socially disadvantaged, that for the most part we've always gravitated towards like the Labour Party. So my own father was a very active trade unionist. So one of the things I take as a badge of honour is that Anthony, as my first name, I'm named after Tony Benn, because Tony Benn actually was one of my dad's heroes. And so there was always this assumption, I think, within a link to the Labour Party. Now, I think one of the difficulties of that relationship is, and I think that is more about, it's more about the left than it is about Black people per se, is that, that although the roots, I think, of a lot of left-wing politics comes out of particularly nonconformist Christianity and also like the Chartist movement in the 19th century, that relationship seems to have been lost. So therefore, part of the difficulty sometimes is, and I can certainly see this in my own life, as someone who's been in and out of the Labour Party ever since I was 18 years old, so I kind of join, stay for a while, some leader says something crap, I resign and leave. Leave for a number of years and feel a bit bad, and then come back again. You know, I mean, so at the moment I'm out of it, you know, because I mean, I left after Corbyn was sort of treated so shabbily. So I left before then. I was in it for a while, but then left when I blessed Tony decided like, to invade Iraq. So I left then. I'm not always sure that people on the left, well, certainly white people on the left, get religion. I mean, that's a huge generalization, I know, because obviously, you know, I mean, you two do, so, you know, so obviously. But certainly I've been in other places, you know. I mean, I've always been a long-standing member of the Cooperative Party, and I'm very much into cooperative politics and into sort of cooperative sort of forms of commerce. That's been part of my life ever since I was a kid, you know. My mum actually was like a member of the co-op, so, you know. And certainly I've been to meetings where people look at you and say, so you're a Christian? And it's like, well, like you do know like the roots of your own party, the Cooperative Party, actually goes back like, to the Rochdale Pioneers and goes back to nonconformist congregational Christians in Lancashire. So part of what I think we've always had to do is to try and have a renewed sense of history so that we understand the antecedents of our understanding of justice and righteousness. I mean, so for example, so my first degree was in history, and I remember reading about Win Stanley and people who were sort of part of the levelers, and this belief in a commonwealth, land for everyone, not private property, distribution of wealth. This notion of a commonwealth actually comes from this biblical vision that comes from Acts chapter 2. So, you know, I'm like, so what I often sort of said to people as well is that part of the reason why I hold the politics I do, influenced by Marx, yes, but actually long before Marx, actually, like there was Acts chapter 2, that's where the disciples share all things in common. And I think it's, what's his name? It's Priscilla and
Aquila,
who sort of tried to hide and cheat and keep their resources for themselves. And we see what happens to them, you know, like they there's a consequence for their selfishness, because there is something about a distribution and a collectivism that is a natural disposition for how we should live, actually, not private property, not the individual control of the means of production. So for me, I guess if I'm being really blunt, And I said this in other places, and people looked at me in horror, but I think I will still say it, that I grew up in a context with my parents and the politics. Like I said, that what was interesting about my parents was that, like, my dad was very political. So as I said, he was a trade unionist. He was on the left. He went to church, but I think that was as much that to please my mum and keep peace in the house. He, you know, I mean, it, okay, like, he's much more religious now, but he wasn't so much when we were growing up. My mum was the real Christian who made us go to church. She said her prayers every day, read the Bible every day. But there was a clear vision that the God we worship was a God of justice and fairness and equity. It was not a God who justified status quo and hierarchy and people feeling that they were more entitled than others. Therefore, when I met people who were Tories in our church, I just genuinely could not understand how they were Christians. And there's a part of me now that still doesn't understand how you can be a Tory and be a Christian. Seriously, just don't, you know. I mean, at one level, I suppose I'm liberal enough to say, okay, so let me just maybe roll back and say, well, you know, God loves everyone and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, okay. So officially, that's my position. But really, it's like, so, you know, I mean, so how can you not read Jesus' encounter with a rich young ruler and not see that as a critique of accumulated wealth? How can you not see the way in which Zacchaeus in Luke 19 becomes part of the movement and then makes reparations, gives back that which is stolen and taken unfairly from others? How can you not see these things as being intrinsic to the very nature of the God we worship? And I've never, seriously, I've just never understood how people could do that. And in the end, I suppose, what I tried to do in my more charitable moments, again, actually learned from James Cone, is to say that there always has to be a certain level of humility in every theologian. And what I mean by that is that as much as I believe I'm right, it's my belief. I don't know I'm right. I believe I'm right. I hope I'm right. But you know something, like, there's always that possibility that when I die and I meet God, I'll just be wrong.
He's the great Tory in the sky.
You know, I could just be wrong. And so long as I hold that in mind, I think it stops it then from being too condemnatory. So what I would say is that, you know, I'm not to go back to the book, Is God Colorblind? You know, it's Is God Colorblind? Question mark. Because I don't know for a fact that God isn't. It's just that on the basis of God's revelation and the scriptures and human experience, I don't believe God is. But I don't know that for a fact. I mean, so all that to say that I've always been, I think, a committed person on the left. And I guess my biggest challenge at the moment in terms of when I work with young people on a more voluntary basis in terms of mentoring and stuff is that quite a lot are apolitical, which... saddens me. But also I think quite a lot are very active in politics but don't see the point of the church or don't see any reason why they should be aligned to anything to do with faith, because too often times, like, the church just seems on the wrong side of the argument, you know, and historically has been on the wrong side of the argument, playing catch up. Now I'm less bothered about the second than the first. If people don't go to the church, you know, I mean, I can live with that. You know, again, as a Black liberation theologian, I'm not hung up on institutions. I'm much more interested in how we inspire people, like, to be activists to try and change the world. In that regard, institutions have their use. So one of the things I would always say about the church at the pragmatic level, that oftentimes attempts to create something that is an alternative vehicle for harnessing people's passion and desire to change the world based on faith ends up looking a bit like the church. So therefore, I think at a pragmatic level, if someone says to me, Anthony, I'm hanging on by my coattails, but I still think I want to hang in with the church, I would say, fine. I will never tell you to join the church. But, you know, I mean, I've never been much of an evangelist because I know too much of the skeletons in the cupboard to tell people to join. But at the same point, I would never condemn you for still being in it, because I can think there's something about being in it that always has the potential for radicalism, even if it's not often expressed.
It's really interesting because I think there's, yeah, some of the things that you're getting at there are, well, traversing that line as someone on the left, you know, between your religious faith and your politics, which to us is just a natural marriage. You know, it's how things are. One of the things I have found really fascinating is that I think younger generations now, and I include, you know, obviously my own in that, they are more skeptical of institutions, understandably, and they are quite, yeah, pointed in their condemnation of some of the roles that institutions, including the church, have played. But what I've found is that they would aim that at institutions rather than me as an individual, which I find really fascinating, because I think in years gone by, it was kind of both. So I lived in a student housing cooperative for a while that was operated, you know, probably, I mean, I don't know, but the majority of the people in there, I think, would call themselves anarchists. And if they weren't anarchists, they were probably Marxists or something. And I was, as I always am, sort of outwardly, people knew I was a Christian. They knew I was an anarchist as well, but they knew I was a Christian. And I never, I had good conversations with people where we disagreed, but I never had any sense that I was being condemned for that. And I think that's one of the, perhaps one of the positive, one of the positives we can take from this part of the conversation, that there, and it's almost coming from this sort of sense that we're almost a more syncretistic kind of culture now. I think. But yeah, I think people are more open than they once were, certainly on the left, to spiritual things. And that means that they can sort of understand where you're coming from as a Christian as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things I remember when I was at uni was how doctrinaire stuff was. I mean, so one of the things I remember certainly, so I was at Birmingham University from 84 to 87. And I remember coming, as I said, coming from Bradford, from a very conservative evangelical church that was, you know, I mean, had clear binary. You know, so basically, if you believed in Jesus Christ, you're Lord and Savior, you're going to heaven. If you don't, you're going to hell. And there were nominal Christians. And by that, that meant that people who went to other churches that we didn't quite like too much, you know, like they were not serious. You know, I mean, so it was a very kind of self-righteous kind of club I was part of. So I got to university. I'm away from home for the first time, away from the shackles of my parents and the kind of a conservative black community. And so I explore other things. And because I've always been on the left, and because of the influence of my dad, although that was put into check by my mom's apolitical, sort of pietistic Christianity, I remember becoming part of the Socialist Workers' Revolutionary Party for about a term. And what struck me actually was how fundamentalist they were, as fundamentalist and as judgmental as the church I'd just come from. So I remember that sort of tumbleweed moment where, like, we're in the bar after our meeting, and I had mentioned in passing that I couldn't make a meeting the next day because I was going to the chaplaincy because, like, we had a Bible study. And it was like silence, and I'm like, what? And it's like, so Comrade Reddy, Bible study, does that mean that you're a Christian? And I'm like, yes, in a very haltering voice. And the silence was palpable. And all of a sudden, literally, people stopped talking to me. It's like, well, you know, because, you know, I mean, like, you can't be part of us, of our gang, properly, if, like, you believe in all this superstitious metaphysical stuff that clearly we have been proved to be, you know. And that was, like, the end of it, you know. I mean, it's like, literally, it was like, well, make your choice. And what was interesting was that if they had not been so didactic about it, I probably would have joined them and left Christianity. Because as I said, at that point, I was away from home. I was reflecting on all the prejudices I'd grown up with in the church I'd been a part of. And bear in mind, at this point, I'm 1920, so I hadn't discovered black theology yet. So I hadn't discovered an alternative version of Christianity. I simply know what I don't believe in and what I'm trying to run away from. I think instinctively, being told that I should give something up, charged the rebellion in me. And I thought, you know something, you lot know better than the people back in Bradford, in my church. Because, you know, I'm like, they would have told me, in the same way that they would have said to me, well, actually, like, we've got this guest speaker coming from Bradford University, who's a professor of peace studies, you should not go and listen to him. And I'm thinking, well, why can't I, you know, why can't I engage? Is in the same way that, like, you're not going to tell me that I can't go I say in a Bible study, particularly it's a Bible study where like we're looking at radical prophets who are sort of speaking truth to power. Yeah, I mean, so that kind of hard line thing has changed. But also I think what has changed as well is that although I think that obviously there are still a lot in church practice and Christianity that is very, very fixed and dogmatic and narrow and conservative, there is an interesting sea change. Now, some of it, I think, is pragmatic. I think some of the churches are realising, actually, like, we're losing so many, well, certainly in the historic tradition, think of Anglicans and Methodists and the URC, for example, but, like, we're losing so many members, can we really afford to be so cavalier around telling certain people that they can't come simply because, like, there's one bit of their life, particularly in terms of their sexuality, that, like, we don't particularly like? I mean, really, you know, I'm like, can we really afford that to be that careless? And therefore, even evangelical friends of mine who, let's say, 30 years ago would have been rabidly anti-LGBTQ and now saying, well, I'm not entirely comfortable, but I can't hold the views I used to hold because like, they're not, that our culture wars are still there, but the lines to it, I think, have been redrawn. I do have a lot of hope, actually, when I think about my nephew, who's 18, and my niece, who's 15, and their worldview, very, very different from the ones that we grew up in. Ones I grew up in. And they have a much more integrated understanding of faith that sees social justice as just being absolutely built into it. Because if not, then you know, I'm not to quote to one of the younger people I sometimes mentor, he says, but Andy, if God doesn't love everyone, and if that doesn't mean that we have to be on the side of those who are suffering, then what's the point? And it's like, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, right? I'm aware that we're starting to run out of time a little bit, and I did want to talk a little bit about the Black Lives Matter movement in the UK.
Yeah, sure.
Obviously, your new edition of Is God Colourblind includes a really interesting afterword on Black Lives Matter, which, yeah, I found really thought-provoking as I read it. Something I'm interested in is thinking a little bit about the way, the differences between the way the Black Lives Matter movement has been received in the UK and in the US. And, you know, I talked a while ago about my feeling that there's almost been a neutering by assimilation approach in the UK to Black Lives Matter. You know, I'm thinking about the way that major sports now have the official kneel for Black Lives Matter kind of moment, which on one side is quite positive, but on another side, it's reduced Black Lives Matter to all racism is bad, which, yes, obviously racism is bad. But I think one thing that the American Black Lives Matter movement has been really successful to do is tie that to specific political demands. But, you know, I don't think the average footballer is kneeling because they think marijuana should be legalized and we should enable black entrepreneurs to take over legal marijuana, or because they oppose the way joint enterprise in this country is used to lock up black kids that have done almost nothing wrong, right?
Yeah.
That isn't really, they're kneeling because, at my most cynical, because they know it's bad press not to.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you've got things like, you know, the people that threw the Colston statue into the harbour were charged, I think it was last week, which, yeah, is... I have a lot of thoughts about that, but we won't get into that right now.
Solidarity, anyway.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Full support. And if anyone knows where that Colston statue is now, then I wouldn't be opposed to you chucking it in a harbour again.
No, neither would I.
But yeah, I'm interested in your thoughts on how that Black Lives Matter movement has kind of happened in the UK, and perhaps as well how we're seeing it impact the church, which is... Yeah, superficially embraced it, certainly white churches, without necessarily taking that full challenge on board.
I think one of the challenges we've always had in the UK, because of the way in which the normalisation and the internalisation of empire, I guess, has happened, is that I think the establishment, and I use that in its broadest sense, media, institutions, the city, politics, parliament and stuff, I think has always had a much more clever and covert way in drawing the sting out of radical movements than necessarily what you get in America. So because America, I think, has had a much more aggressively different relationship with race and with power. After all, that's a nation that's built on genocide, you know. That within Britain, the our level of injustice have always been much more filtered, as I said, I think sort of through this aegis of empire, that always has ways of softening things and ways of, I think, sort of drawing the sting of it. So therefore, think about our own civil rights movement. You know, I mean, there was a civil rights movement in Britain in the 60s, but it was much more contained than it was in America, because it was largely contained because actually what we often do is that we don't necessarily frame laws to oppress people. We control them through forms of, I guess, culture and manners. So therefore, I think your analysis around the sort of commodification, let's say, of the Black Lives Matter is entirely accurate. That what has happened is that it's now been reduced almost to a few set pieces around gesture politics. So it's either taking the knee on the one hand, or it's a debate around statues, you know, so let's protect our statues. Well, yeah, okay, you know. Was I said when Colson got pulled down? No, absolutely not. But actually, there's a much bigger issue about Bristol being probably actually one of the most segregated cities in Britain, and about where wealth is concentrated and where poverty is very contained within certain parts of the city that are almost literally cut off from the rest by the M32 going right through it. Those are much bigger, harder questions to wrestle with than whether a statue should have been pulled down or not.
Yeah.
And therefore, I think one of the things that we constantly have to do within a British context, which is why it requires a broader coalition, so we get all the different facets of the vision in front of us rather than just a limited parochial view that any one particular position will give you, is real hard analysis that says, so what's a vested interest here? What are we not being told? What are we not seeing? Why do we need as many people around the table? For those of us who are in an oppositional coalition, actually sort of working for revolution, because like we know how institutional life in Britain has a way of drawing the teeth out of stuff. You know, I mean, so I'm part of Oxford University and I've only been there for a year. But what's been interesting is the efforts that the institution is making to bring about a process of decolonization. And I'm sure that the people involved in it are genuine. But what's interesting is that it operates in a seemingly contained manner that then leaves lots of other conversations untouched. I say that not to be overly hard on Oxford, not least of all the fact that obviously like they employ me. So to say that I think happens in our churches. So, you know, I mean, so churches have always been much more comfortable with social welfare than social justice. I'm not the first to say that. We're good at being kind and being generous. We're not so good at asking like the hard justice question as to why our intervention is necessary in the first place, when certainly the whole point of being part of a democratic state is that all of us, therefore, actually shall have equal access like, to issues of justice and equity, and not just some. Those are much harder things to get at, actually, when the state has been very good at always camouflaging its worst intent and buying off, I think, the very well-intentioned people on the middle ground who will always be seducing to believing that things are not so bad over here. Because, you know, like, yeah. You know, and that's one of the first things I heard is, oh, yeah, but our police don't carry guns, so it's not so bad over here. Really? I mean, seriously?
I went to a Black Lives Matter protest in rural Norfolk, where I live, and in some ways it was really heartening because there was loads of people coming out in what is an extremely white and an extremely right-wing area, really. Ooh. And that was really heartening. And there was lots of good stuff there, but I do remember one of the speakers said, this isn't about cops. We love police officers. And I was like, I'm sorry. I think you might need to Google Black Lives Matter and find out how this started.
Exactly. Exactly.
Really quickly, I was really interested in the afterword. You suggest that reparations are a Christian response to the Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
I think that's probably the first time I've seen the case for reparations made in a British context. It's obviously, you know, quite a topic in America that is dealt with sometimes. But I'm interested to really quickly hear you talk about reparations.
Well, it's both a practical economic matter and it's deeply a theological one. So I think one of the things that if we think about James Cone and that cross of the lynching tree, so Cone says there's theological significance in the cross. The cross is about sacrifice and struggle. That Jesus gets crucified because he's in opposition to the Romans. There is a struggle and a sacrifice to be made. And we know that whatever one thinks about whatever happens on Sunday morning in terms of resurrection, whether it's a physical resurrection or whether it's a metaphor or whatever, this remains true. That can't happen without Jesus having gone to the cross and died for the principles of trying to bring about revolutionary change in the first place. All that to say that if there is no sacrifice to be made, then there can be no reconciliation and no transformation. So therefore, what I take also, coming from probably like the best white theologian of the 20th century, which is like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, it is notion of costly grace. That for Britain to believe in reconciliation with its black people, in terms of Black Lives Matter, in terms of particularly those of us who come from enslaved backgrounds, without reparation, without sacrifice, without making recompense, then there can be no justice and there can be no reconciliation. And without reparations, you can't say that Black Lives Matter, because it's simply cheap grace. It's wants to have change without having to make any cost for it.
Yeah.
The cross tells us that change is costly, even to the point of sacrificial death, even to the point of sacrificial death. And finally to say, and again, it's hidden in plain sight. So when Jesus asks, actually, so if we want to be your disciple, what do we have to do? Jesus says, well, you deny self, pick up your cross and follow me. The scandal of imperial Christianity is that we've made picking up the cross a purely spiritual thing, actually, and not an economic and a materialistic one that says, actually, that means sacrifice and that means actually making reparations.
Yeah, absolutely. Anthony, thank you so much for joining us. That was an incredibly fascinating conversation. I'm really grateful that you've spent the time to chat to us. If people want to hear more from you or know more about you, where can they find you in the world?
I'm generally on Twitter, and people are free to befriend me on Facebook. I'm probably a bit too old for other social platforms. I mean, so I think Twitter and Facebook is about as far as I go. You know, Snapchat and other stuff. No, I'm sorry, too old for that. Yeah, so that, yeah. And I've got a website, so www.anthonyreddy.com, so they can contact me there.
And I would absolutely encourage people to seek out Anthony's work, because it is excellent, and I think if you particularly are a white person in the UK who's a member of your church, then you need to be thinking about black theology in order to do justice to your Christian faith and to deal with the world around you in a way that takes account of the racism of the world and the church. So, and I have to say, it is extraordinarily easy reading. It does not get bogged down in long, difficult academic words and ideas that no one apart from three people can understand. So I would absolutely encourage you to go and find that work. Even an idiot like me can understand it, which is high praise indeed. You can find the podcast on the usual podcast feed places. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/breadandrosaries. We're on Twitter @bread_rosaries. You can email us at breadandrosaries@gmail.com. Adam, I'm going to ask you where in the world people can find you, and you're going to have to admit that after Anthony knew the right thing for his age and he's only on Twitter and Facebook, that you are somehow letting yourself be on TikTok.
Look, man, TikTok is a cool, you know what, it's brilliant, and I know I'm too old for it, but it's really funny, and yeah, if you want to find me, you can find me on there, on Twitter, on various places, @commiexian.
Brilliant. You can find me on Twitter @Molino, M-O-L-O-N-O, and you shouldn't follow me because I'll just be being mean to Adam about things. That's usually the way of it. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you both for joining me. It's been a great conversation. And we'll see the listeners next time.
See you next time.
Goodbye. Take care. Still here, still grinding, hustling.
working and striving. In these dark times, these dark minds, I'm a diamond. Big Ben is still chiming. They don't want to see us smiling. They want to keep us grimy. But my politics too lively, still here amongst the sirens. Thunderclaps and violence down Dustin Lane, I'm scribing. No visits from your highness. Still here, my dear, despite the prophecies of seers. Smash the pieces on the pier, put myself back like IKEA. Still here amongst the brass. Garments watching stars. London wind is biting. Ah, shiver my tin moustache. I'm crude but not into class. Willing and able and up to the task. They go low, we go high, it's a fact. They go low, we go high like tax. Still here and cool. Still here like Queen Kasum. Chilling like leaves in pool. In school like tomatoes too. Ooh, stood on the shoulders of grapes. In my hands, mapping on fate. Made my enemies eat the cake. Cry me a river, cry me a lake. Still here, God willing. Old rebels still reveling. Calm inside the kettle in. Calm though times are settling. Don't want the beef that I'm serving. Feline amongst these vermin. Black and proud and determined. Jumped in the wall, left with no stitch. Ate with the priest, tried with the witch. Man's a ninja bridge. Heartbreak wherever my flag is pitched. Cutting my hunger for fine things. Learning the lesson that time brings. Acquired taste for London pride. Spread my wings in these noxious skies. In these streets where foxes hide. I'm not yet old and not so wise. I take the strife in my stride. I must admit it's tough at times. But most don't let the eye dive in. This never, 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 never ending pressure piling on. I'm still here, still unruly.